Now may the words of my lips and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. And so, as I mentioned a few moments ago, this is the second sermon in what is a very brief, a far too brief look at some of the implications of modern technology for human life. I hasten to make those points at the outset, noting first that two sermons is far too brief for a subject this complex, but noting as well that this is part of a two-part series, a reminder offered with special concerns for folks who were not here last Sunday. I emphasize that because the sermon you are about to hear is rather bleak, since it will be naming some of my very real concerns, not only about technologies projected for the future, but about technologies we already possess. I therefore need to remind those who were here last Sunday and point out to those who were not that my focus a week ago was on the very many blessings, we have received as a result of technological advances. I hope and pray that nothing I say this morning will cause us to forget that we are debtors, to those who have created in a wide range of technological fields. To put that succinctly, any discussion of technology and humanity must surely strike a note of gratitude. From where I stand, that is an indispensable starting point. Nevertheless, there is another side. So let's start with the prophet Isaiah, second Isaiah, if we're going to be technical, and ponder his powerful warning against idolatry. And you know, the danger here, I think, especially in an era when researchers in the field of robotics are designing robots that are increasingly human-like in their design, the danger, I think, is that we can take Isaiah's warning against idol worship in a far too narrow way. But what I'm getting at here is my sense that it's a mistake to restrict fear of idolatry to that narrow band of technology that involves the creation and utilization of robots and androids. Quite frankly, I think that trivializes the challenge we face. Namely, the challenge of discerning the idols we so readily worship. I believe the real challenge here is the extent to which we can fall into the trap of worshiping technology considered as a whole, a tendency which reveals itself most tellingly when we begin with the presumption that each and every challenge facing humanity is bound to have a technological fix. And you know, it's hard to resist falling into that trap. I know I have to resist it myself. Given the very real progress that has been made in the resolution of seemingly impossible challenges we human beings have faced, resolution attained through technological wizardry. Given how much we owe to technology, given how much we owe to what I described last Sunday is that marvelous marriage of science and craft, is it any wonder that we're always tempted to place it on a pedestal? Which is why it can be helpful, depressing, but helpful, to pull back from our admiration every so often in order to ponder the at times unsettling underbelly of technological change. The unintended consequences, so to speak, of the marvels that surround us, as well as the marvels that are promised for the human future. And so let's begin with a handful of the marvels that are already here. Well, to bring back a greatest hit from last Sunday, the first such marvel is the facial recognition technology I made reference to. At the end of the service, when I was back there shaking hands, I mentioned to a handful of you that the challenge for this week would be selecting, choosing which examples of disturbing technology I would mention. One person, when I said that, snapped back, "Will Foster, you don't need to go any further than that example from China you used this morning." That was a reference, for those of you who weren't here or have forgotten, to an experiment conducted by a writer for Reason magazine, a libertarian publication. He was touring China and visiting one of their larger cities, a city of nearly 5 million people. The experiment involved the police uploading his face to facial recognition software and then feeding that data to the many surveillance cameras throughout the city. Using that sophisticated technology, he was found and arrested in roughly 7 minutes. I'm reminded of Lord Acton's famous dictum, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." Given the propensity of even the most benign government to seek to establish control of its populace, and given how easily even the most seemingly stable of societies can find itself turning to authoritarian leaders during times of crisis, it may well be the case that it is only a matter of time before there will be tools at the disposal of most governments that will be used to enact the sort of deadening conformity George Orwell envisioned in his masterpiece, 1984. Not that overbearing government is likely to be the only source of conformity we face over the coming years. Indeed. In addition to enhancing the power of government, modern technologies increasingly appear to be enhancing the power of the mob. Don't take my use of the word mob as a reference to the mafia. That's not what I'm after. No, what I refer to here are the online mobs that are an increasingly ugly side of human life in a technological age. A particularly horrific instance of the way in which technology can bring out the very worst in humanity can be found in the awful events that unfolded earlier this month right here in British Columbia, in Langley, in which Carson Cremeny, a 14-year-old boy, apparently he was awkward and hungry for acceptance, was lured by a group of older boys into taking a dangerous amount of drugs. As he became increasingly incoherent, he was mocked by those older boys and filmed so that those films could be shared online. At the end of the episode, he was simply left there to die. A recent article in the National Post poses the pertinent question. Cremeny's death has exposed a problem. It reveals a huge gap in what we know about how kids exist in the world today. The teens involved in Cremeny's death did something cruel, and they filmed it. What we don't know is whether they did it so they could film it, or whether they simply filmed something they always would have done. It's a chicken and egg problem, and it gets to the core of how teenage and even adult lives are being lived in an era where everyday moments are being processed and shared and turned into content on a massive scale. Does social media make young people more likely to do cruel things, the author asks? Things that are more extreme than they otherwise would have done? Or are we simply seeing things now by virtue of social media that have been happening all along? And yes, similar questions need to be raised concerning the online activities of those far older than the teenagers who egged Carson Cremeny onto his death. I refer to what have become known as Twitter mobs. Twitter mobs. Rightly so, since of all the social media to have emerged over the past 20 years, Twitter in many ways is in a class of its own. In the case of a so-called Twitter mob, here's what typically happens. Somebody posts something regrettable online, something foolish or offensive or both. Someone else notices. using Twitter and other forms of social media and online mob forms to denounce the offender, for whom the consequences can be devastating. Not only losing their present employment, this isn't fiction, this has happened, not only losing their present employment, but in some cases becoming virtually unemployable, with some online mobs going so far as to threaten to have the offender's spouse fired from their job. Here again, we can take a wee bit of comfort in the thought that the only thing new technologies have accomplished is amplifying an unfortunate aspect of human life that has always been there, with or without technology. But I wonder, as one insightful New York Times article suggests, social media is perfectly designed to manipulate our desire for approval, and I would add, our delight in expressing disapproval. In other words, it's not just that social media amplifies human nastiness, it's that social media may very well cause us to be nastier than we otherwise would be. Scary. And no less scary, to cite a final example, is the way in which the internet in general, and Twitter in particular, have diminished the place of the thoughtful exchange of ideas, especially between those in different ideological camps. Dialogue is the hallmark of a civilized political environment. But dialogue is simply not possible in the 140-character universe of Twitter, in which it's far easier to trade insults than to trade ideas. In general, even if we ignore the particularly pernicious implications of Twitter, the internet as a whole has tended to diminish the powers of human concentration. Speaking personally, I know that far more of my reading nowadays involves article length rather than book length endeavors. Now, in part, that's a function of the fact that I'm now 68 years old. I can see that. But in part, it is most certainly a function of life online, which has unquestionably impacted our powers of concentration. The medium may not be the message in quite the way Marshall McLuhan anticipated, but the medium has certainly diminished our capacity to hear whatever message is being transmitted. That too is a consequence of the technological revolution that has already taken place in our midst, most of it during our lifetimes, much of it over the past 20 years. And here's where we launch into outer space. Far harder to characterize are the dangers posed by technologies that have been promised for the human future. Here we enter terrain that is deeply contested between those visionaries who are fully convinced about the coming dawn of a technological revolution, one that will far exceed any humanity has yet to experience, over against those who remain somewhat skeptical. In many ways, the key concept is that of the technological singularity. Please note that the word singularity, if you look it up, can be used in a variety of ways. It's a mathematical concept. It has a wide range of uses. So if you want to learn more about singularity in this sense, it's important to preface it with technological singularity, which will get you to articles describing this. The technological singularity basically refers to some future time, although keep in mind that some futurologists argue that time will be within the lifetime of some of the younger people here today. The technological singularity refers to a time when technological process becomes unstoppable, largely because it will then be under the control not of human actors, but of technologies powered by artificial intelligence. In short, the singularity refers to the possibility of the arrival of a time when our technologies will have so surpassed even the best and brightest of human beings that they will no longer require our assistance in order to create the future, including the human future. And no, it doesn't take an especially high IQ to imagine the most obvious danger that possibility poses, namely that the robots we design to serve us will turn against us. Many of you will remember the computer HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey. HAL, in case you don't recall, decided to disobey the commands being issued by the human beings on board his spacecraft, going so far as to murder members of the crew. Whether or not it would be possible to build into artificial intelligence programming that would prevent such devices from turning against their human creators is one of the most hotly contested questions in the whole realm of artificial intelligence. My hunch is that we will never have an entirely satisfactory answer to that question as our technologies grow increasingly sophisticated. Now, a more subtle problem, I believe, than the question of whether our technologies would turn against us involves the very real challenge vis-a-vis our treatment of them. Many years ago, I read a compelling piece whose author argued that what we are presently witnessing is the creation of a new life form, that we were, in effect, witnessing the emergence of silicon-based life that would eventually live side by side with carbon-based life. Given the immensity of the leap that will need to be made in order for that to come to fruition, after all, while computers have become quite adept at intellectual challenges we find difficult, such as chess or the even more complex Japanese game of Go, it's been far trickier to program them with human-like emotions or human-like instincts in terms of social interaction. But if eventually those challenges are met and there emerged a race of androids who in every particular were like human beings, how would that change and how would that challenge human self-understanding? Even if these new creatures were truly on our side, how intimidating would it be for us to interact on a daily basis with beings who were like us in every regard, other than the inconvenient fact that they were infinitely stronger than the most physically well-developed human and infinitely more intellectually capable than even the brightest human? Now, the optimists, those who believe fervently in our technological future, argue that we will change in order to meet the challenge of living side by side with silicon-based others. Pessimists argue that even the ongoing threat to employment posed by these technologies guarantees that we humans will find ways to sabotage progress once those threats get beyond a critical mass. Hard to say, although there's no reason to think that our generation of Luddites will be any more successful in stopping technological progress than previous generations. What cannot be denied is the inevitably disruptive nature, of all technological change. Embrace it or run from it, there can be no getting away from the opportunities, but also the dangers posed by the changing world of wonders we are privileged to call our home. Well, this has been a far from adequate survey of some of the challenges we face. I realize that I have failed even to allude, although I guess I'm about to do it, to some of the changes on the horizon as a result of genetic engineering. Putting the science fiction possibility of silicon-based life to the side, what will the implications be for the future of human society if the already growing class divide in advanced societies is heightened by the divide between those who have the means to conceive designer babies and those who do not possess those means? Would we see the advent of a time when Nietzsche's prophecy of the coming of the Übermensch, the Superman, becomes a reality? And what would be the relationship between these genetically modified, genetically engineered superhumans be, and mere mortals such as you and I? In some ways, that's a possibility no less chilling than that of malevolent androids treating us as second-class citizens. And boy, is it tempting to dream up all of the laws that someone somewhere ought to be legislating to protect us from these dangers. Just as it's tempting to jump on board with the more optimistic of the futurologists to presume that none of these problems will ever play out. Call me a skeptic, but my gut tells me, more to the point, the fallenness of our world tells me that there's pretty good reason to presume, A, that there will be some unhappy consequences to go with our new technologies, and B, that there may not be a legislative quick fix to those challenges. Indeed, if we imagine that passing laws will do anything other than drive scientists and technicians underground, then I suspect we're kidding ourselves. All of which puts me in mind of a conversation I had with a technician, a fellow who came into my house many months ago to repair a misfiring piece of technology in my kitchen. We got chatting as he worked, and it became obvious that he was not only a skilled technician, but something of an armchair philosopher. Widely read in the area of technology and in the area of social change. He made the point, once he found out that I was a United Church minister, that the churches may very well be called to play a decisive role as one of the places where true community can be found over the coming decades. And you know, even if the more glowing predictions about the technological future never take root, the very fact that we already live in an age where it's easier to trade insults over the internet than to form meaningful bonds over the internet, all of that suggests that my technician friend was not far off the mark in terms of there being a pressing need for places where human beings will still have the opportunity to come face to face outside of a work setting. Now, what that might entail for the church, what that might entail for this church going forward, is of course a very big topic, a topic for another day, but a topic that ought not to be swept under the rug. That there is still a hunger for purpose and meaning, and that much of our human hunger for purpose and meaning can be found in community is something technology is not likely to change. And so, yes, here is my prayer. May you and I, who have tasted the very special community that is ours through Christ and through the Spirit, never be tempted to hide our light under a bushel. May we have the strength of conviction to know that we most certainly do have something priceless to offer. And may we have the courage and, yes, the humility to offer that gift wisely and well. Amen.